Our Father and our God, we thank Thee that Thou art the Lord of history, that Thou didst come into history in the person of Thy Son, Jesus Christ, to tell us what the plan of history means and to redeem us from its sin and evil. And we pray that we may come to Thee to understand the meaning of the past and to find the true values for our life. We pray that as we see Thy gospel as the means to an understanding of the world, we may be outfitted to present that answer to those who need Thee as much as we do. We pray these things in the name of Thy Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Tonight we are making our attack on enemy territory. What we mean by this is that we want to show in what sense Christ is the answer to people trying to explain the nature of their existence. We've been spending our sessions so far in giving positive evidence for the truth of the Christian faith. And that positive evidence is fundamental and central to the Christian apologetic. The way to do apologetics is to offer the positive evidence that the Christian faith is true. It isn't to knock down other people's positions, nor is it simply to reiterate the Christian position. But we occasionally find ourselves in situations where the non-Christian thinks that his own view of life is adequate, that his understanding of the world is sufficient, and therefore there isn't any need to shift off of the position which he maintains to something else. And therefore, we want to see what problems logically lie with any non-Christian position. If we can analyze the nature of non-Christian positions, we'll see that there are certain fundamental difficulties with them that make it impossible for these positions to succeed in understanding the world. And therefore, if we find ourselves talking with a non-Christian who is satisfied with his own position, we can learn how to deal with that to show him why he does in fact need Jesus Christ. We don't suggest that you begin refuting the non-Christian's views. That approach is taken by some apologists. Francis Schaeffer seems to suggest that that's the proper approach. He says that the best thing to do is to show the non-Christian, first of all, that his own position is inconsistent, that he can't sustain his own position, and then when he recognizes his need on that basis, then you go ahead and you proclaim the Christian faith. I think that tactically, that is not the best way to proceed. There are instances where that may be necessary, where the non-Christian simply will not pay any attention to the Christian faith because of the view he already holds. But in general, it is not a wise idea to start out refuting the other guy's position. When you do this, you automatically irritate the other person. You create an aggressive attitude on his part, and you make your own witness that much more difficult. Nobody likes to have his own views dealt with negatively. The approach that we're suggesting here is, if you will, to cut him off at the pass. In other words, to provide such positive evidence in behalf of the Christian faith that other views will have to fall because those views are inconsistent with the Christian faith. The idea being that once you have demonstrated that Christianity has the evidence for it, then any view which goes against the Christian view can't very well coexist with it. Our approach then is a positive approach, and that's why we've spent our time on the positive evidences for Christianity. But now we want to go ahead and deal with this special instance of the individual who insists on his non-Christian view and who simply will not move off of it. Another consideration here is this, that you should never get the idea that by refuting another person's views you establish your own. There is the thought, evidently, on the part of some Christian apologists that if you show non-Christians that their views are wrong, that necessarily establishes the Christian faith. Of course, it doesn't do anything of the kind. The only way it would do that would be if you knew that the number of possible world views was, let's say, 687, that there were only 687 possible world views. Then, of course, if you refuted 686 of them, the remaining one would have to be true without any evidence in its behalf. But obviously you could never establish anything like that. In a contingent universe, people can conceive of any number of worldviews. So it never establishes your view that you have successfully refuted X number of other views. You see the logic of this. And so under those circumstances, the approach to take is, first of all, to give the positive evidence for the Christian view. Where the non-Christian will not listen to this, where he insists upon his own viewpoint, you need to be able to deal with his viewpoint. And what we're going to try to do tonight is to find the central difficulty that exists in non-Christian worldviews. It would be futile to try and discuss particular worldviews in a great deal of detail, since the non-Christian you meet and talk with tomorrow might very well maintain a view different from those that we've dealt with. So what we want to do is to see if we can find some basic, fundamental problem that exists in non-Christian worldviews, which you can then apply to whatever approach the non-Christian happens to take. And I think that we can show you that there is an underlying fallacy in non-Christian attempts to explain the world, which eliminates the possibility of success for the non-Christian. It isn't that the non-Christian isn't trying hard enough. It isn't that he is lazy or without sufficient initiative. The fact is that even when he has done his very best, he has three strikes against him and simply can't arrive at a satisfactory explanation of the world. We're going to illustrate this by way of two major areas. First of all, the philosophy of history, the meaning of history. And then secondly, ethics and law. We're going to show that in the area of history and in the area of ethics and law, the non-Christian simply can't get final solutions. And the underlying principle you can then take and apply to other attempts on the part of non-Christians to understand the nature of things. You'll see that the problem is a fundamental one, an underlying one, which doesn't depend upon the particular area of analysis at all. The areas of philosophy of history and philosophy of law, then, that we will be talking about tonight are simply illustrative. And if you're not terribly interested in those illustrations, that's all right. The important thing is to get the underlying principle, and that will be entirely clear to you. All right, let's begin with the meaning of history. And a book that will be of interest to you in that regard back there on the table is the book The Shape of the Past. The Shape of the Past goes into this in considerable detail, and to a lesser extent, the book Where is History Going? Those books that I mentioned in connection with the historical argument for Christ on Wednesday night. Those books go into the sort of thing that I'm talking about now in a good deal more detail than I'm able to tonight. When we deal with the meaning of law and ethics, the stuff back there on the table that will be of interest to you consists of the Jurisprudence Reader, that big fat blue book, and then also the Law Above the Law. Those two are the ones pertinent to the second part of what we'll be talking about tonight. All right, we begin with the meaning of history. And here you must jump into my little time machine and go flashing back to the 19th century. We mentioned the 19th century in our very first session. We pointed out that in the 19th century, people had a progressivistic, confident view of life. Everything was coming up progress. You remember the train that laid its own tracks. People thought that success in life and the understanding of the universe was just around the corner, and that they were capable of arriving at a meaningful view of things under their own steam. Two of the most influential philosophies of history in modern times developed in the middle of the 19th century. One of them was Hegel's philosophy of history. The other, the philosophy of history of Karl Marx. And we want to talk about each of those for a moment, because those views have come to influence secular man's thinking to a greater extent than perhaps any other. Hegel said that the history of the world is a history of progress, of inevitable progress, rising to the final goal of freedom. Said Hegel, history consists of four world historical epochs. The Greco-Roman and the medieval and so on. And finally, you arrive at the Germanic epoch. And the Germanic epoch precedes the ultimate fulfillment of history. Now, why does history move onward and upward in this fashion? Said Hegel, it does so because ideas influence history, and ideas operate dialectically. By the word dialectically, Hegel meant in terms of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Let me explain exactly what is involved here. Said Hegel, one idea, we'll call it the thesis, spawns its opposite, produces its opposite. We'll call that the antithesis. The two of these interact, and out of them comes a synthesis, which is an idea partaking of the positive elements of both the thesis and the antithesis. The synthesis, in turn, becomes a new thesis, which spawns its opposite, and out of the interaction of the new thesis and the new antithesis, you get a higher level synthesis. In other words, history is the product of the continual refinement of ideas. Ideas are continually refined in this fashion. Bigger bugs have littler bugs upon their backs to bite them, and littler bugs have littler bugs, and so ad infinitum. The dialectic moves onward and upward by the interaction of thesis and antithesis, spawning new syntheses. These produce new antitheses, and on the process goes. It doesn't, however, strictly go ad infinitum. It goes ad libertatem, to the final goal of freedom. Marx said that he turned Hegel on his head. What did Marx mean by that? He meant simply that instead of ideas being fundamental, material things are fundamental. Marx conceives of the onward and upward movement of history as materialistic rather than idealistic. It isn't ideas that interplay for Marx. It is material things, and specifically economic things. Economic factors in history carry history onward and upward to a final goal. Since the process, for Marx, is materialistic, the goal is materialistic. You end up with a classless society. This is the way Marx conceived of the operation. Material things are more important than anything else. Materialism is the base of the Marxist system. Material things operate dialectically. And here the word means just what it does in Hegel. Marx simply took over Hegel's dialectic. And in the interaction of economic factors, you will finally arrive at the classless society. This is how it works. Marx talked about the economic theory of surplus value. What that meant was that in society, some people have control of the means of production. Other people don't. The people who have control of the means of production make life very difficult for those who don't own the means of production. In other words, the capitalists who own the means of production want to get maximum profit out of the system, and so they make life less and less attractive for the proletariat, which does not own the means of production. But ironically, says Marx, the only wealth that the capitalist really has is the worker. It's only in the workers that there is any genuine wealth. So, as the capitalist grinds down upon the proletarian, he loses at the same time the proletarian loses. And the situation ultimately gets to the point where the proletariat recognizes that it has nothing to lose but its chains if it revolts. That expression, of course, comes from Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto. At the very end, the Communist Manifesto is a call to arms to the proletariat. It says, you have nothing to lose but your chains, therefore revolt. And that must inevitably come about because the proletariat eventually gets to the point where it is gaining nothing, and everything is in process of destruction anyway. So there is a class war. And in the class war, inevitably, the proletariat wins because the proletariat has nothing to lose. And once the class war occurs, the proletariat comes into control. There is a temporary dictatorship of the proletariat. The proletariat maintains a dictatorial control of society, cleaning up the last vestiges of capitalism. And once that has occurred, the state is no longer necessary. The state then winnows away. The state simply disappears because it's no longer needed. The state was only necessary in order to keep the lid on the garbage can, if you will. It was necessary only to prevent the proletariat from rising up. Once the proletariat has done so, you no longer have a need for that sort of thing. So the state disappears, law disappears, and the capitalist lion, if there are any still around, lies down with the proletarian lamb, and the classless society comes about. Incidentally, the materialism of Marx was picked up from a German philosopher by the name of Ludwig Feuerbach, F-E-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. The word in German means firewater, Feuerbach, or fire spring, if you will, and the incongruity of fire and water is most appropriate in his name. That's another name that gives you a feeling of great satisfaction. In any case, Feuerbach argued that everything is materialistically based. Indeed, religion is materialistically based, and diet is fundamental to everything. Feuerbach coined the phrase, Der Mensch ist, was ist. Man is what he eats. It sounds a lot better in German because of the play on ist and ist, I-S-T and I-S-S-T. But in any case, everything could be dealt with in terms of diet. And Feuerbach suggested that philosophers do well on a diet of beans. He never explains exactly why. I have a feeling I know, but I don't want to go into the details of this. In any case, the Marxist system is materialistic at root and is progressivistic, rising to an ultimate goal, parallel with the sort of thing that Hegel does. The difference is that Hegel is operating in terms of ideas and Marx is operating in terms of material considerations. All right, when we look at these philosophies of history today, we are very much surprised that anybody would naively present that kind of thing. We are amazed at what appears to be the naivete of those systems. Look at Hegel, for example. Says Hegel, everything is going onward and upward, progressively to the goal of freedom, and the Germanic period is ushering that in. We say, good grief, how could anybody think that? But of course, that's because we have a perspective that Hegel didn't have. If you were operating in the second half of the 19th century, things would have looked to you as if they were coming up not roses, but Germanic. Because finally, after centuries of decentralization and weakness, Germany was becoming a major national state. That's the period of the rise of the Prussian military caste, Bismarck, and finally in 1870-71, the first German victory in Europe, which was a victory over France, the country that had maintained not only a cultural conquest of Europe, but also the greatest military force in Europe up to that point. Germany wins, and it looks like everything is coming up German. We today look back on that, and we take a very, very different kind of view. We see the rising German power in the 19th century not as a precursor to freedom, but something very different. Actually, as a result of that kind of situation, two of the most hideous wars in human history took place in our time, and you got unfreedom rather than freedom as a result of it. But Hegel, of course, didn't have that perspective. We also look at this progressivistic business, and we wonder how anybody could have conceived of things that way. Why? Because we look back from the standpoint of the two world wars. But in the 19th century, it looked to Hegel as if everything was going onward and upward. You know, even early in our century, the French autosuggestionist, Émile Coué, the psychologist who believed in autosuggestion, self-suggestion, said that you ought to say every morning and every evening, every day, in every way, we are getting better and better. Every day, in every way, we are getting better and better. And said Coué, you will become better. Actually, you become hoarse if you say that every morning and every evening. You don't become better. But from the standpoint of the 19th century and the early 20th century before the First World War, it really looked that way. It looked like things were going better and better. So what we see in Hegel is a victim of his own time. A victim of his own time. Which, of course, doesn't make him unique. Everybody is, to some extent, a victim of his own time. Everybody looks out on the world from the standpoint of his own era. Think of the dialectic for a moment. Hegel assumes that the dialectic goes onward and upward. But of course, a dialectic wouldn't have to, would it? You could have a greater refinement of evil as well as a greater refinement of good. Think of a situation where two criminals end up in jail in the same cell. One is a specialist in blowing safes, and the other is a specialist with a machine gun. The specialist blowing safes states a thesis, namely that the best way to take care of the First National Bank is to blow the safe. This immediately produces an antithesis. The other fellow says, not on your life. The best way to do this is to go in and mow everybody down with a machine gun. And then you have no trouble getting the money out of the bank. Well, the thesis and the antithesis interact. There is a dynamic interaction between them. And eventually the two of them get out of jail and a perfect synthesis occurs. They go into the bank and first they mow everybody down and then they blow the safe. There we have a synthesis partaking of the best elements of two hideous ideas. See? In other words, it's perfectly possible for a dialectic to go down as well as going up. Why did Hegel think it went up? Because everybody thought things went up in the 19th century. That was the period of Horatio Alger in America, you know, begin as the messenger boy, and later, by dint of effort, you will become president of the company. That was the period of Darwinian evolution, wasn't it? You know, when Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859, the New York Times reviewer, you can check this out if you want, the New York Times reviewer in 1860 said, Darwin is just telling us what we knew already. He's giving us a scientific basis for what we already know. Namely, that man is evolving, is getting better. The reason that Darwin was so readily accepted was because Darwin fitted perfectly into the notion of progress, which was endemic in the 19th century. Actually, Darwin has very little to say about human evolution, practically nothing, just a few suggestions in the last chapter of The Origin of Species. It's a pedestrian kind of attempt to deal with certain biological phenomena. Marx was more aware of the value of Darwin than Darwin was. Do you know that Marx wanted to dedicate the English translation of Das Kapital to Darwin? And he wrote to Darwin and asked him if he could do it. And of course, Darwin was horrified at the thought of a revolutionary dedicating a book to him. Darwin was a rather introverted Englishman, and he denied Marx permission to do this. Marx wrote to Engels and he said, "Of course, Darwin's work is written in the typically turgid English style, but it is the scientific basis of our work." Isn't that interesting? Marx recognized that the kind of progressivistic materialism that he was talking about needed a scientific, biological base which would involve progressivism, leading up to man and pushing man onward along the dialectic. Well, we have then in Hegel naivete, but naivete which is understandable because it is connected with his own time. Same thing with Marx. Look at Marx. He also assumes that the dialectic has got to go onward and upward. Why? Certainly doesn't have to. He is, again, a creature of his own time. He assumes that the only way that the inequities and the means of production in society will ever be dealt with is by revolution. Why does he think that? Because he looks at the year 1848, the year of revolutions, when it appeared that that was the way social problems would be solved. We today look back on this and we don't see any necessity of revolution because labor unions have organized, the proletariat has gotten organized to such an extent that it often is more powerful than the capitalists. We also see government intervening. We see antitrust laws like the Sherman Act of 1890 prevents capital from expanding to the expense of the proletariat. And we see the workers buying stock in the companies and the lines blurred between capital and labor so that it's very difficult to determine where capital ends and labor begins. Marx didn't have the benefit of that. Today, you know, the average assembly line worker is more concerned with the quality of his television reception so that he can watch football while drinking beer on Saturday afternoon than he is with making plastique bombs in the cellar. In our 20th century, there isn't this radical necessity of revolution, evidently, to solve such economic problems. And, of course, Marx was hopelessly naive in his view of human nature. In a sense, the Marxist system is like an old American movie. You remember the old American Westerns with the bad guys clearly identified and the good guys clearly identified? You have the ones in the white hats, and that eliminates any question as to the interpretation of the film. The ones in the white hats are the good ones, and the ones in the black hats are the bad ones. In the Marxist system, the bad guys are the capitalists, and the good guys are the proletariat. The bad guys are the ones that need to be eliminated, and once you've gotten rid of them, then everything is fine. But we well recognize, don't we, that you can't distinguish bad guys and good guys that way. Milovan Delos, the Yugoslavian, wrote a work entitled The New Class, and he argues that under a Marxist system, you don't get a classless society. You simply get a new class, namely the Marxist bureaucrats, who then grind down on everybody else. Instead of the capitalists grinding down, as they did in the capitalist system, you get the bureaucrats grinding down on everybody else. It's then the Politburo who has the Mercedes automobiles and the Cadillacs and the Citroën, and who drive around in great in a position like the aristocracy did earlier. There's no way to get rid of classes. The best thing you can do is to substitute one class for another. Delos has not gotten along too well in Yugoslavia. He has spent a good deal of his time in the Huzgal. Tito and Delos are not on the very best terms. But this is an indication of the recognition in our time, even within a communist society, as to the limitations of Marxist theory. All right, the problem here then is a problem of perspective, isn't it? People who try to understand the meaning of history are limited to their own position in history. Thus, they are not able to see history as a whole, spelled again, W-H-O-L-E. They're not able to see it in its extent and totality. They're only able to look at it from their own position in it. The result of this is that no matter how hard they try, they are not able to provide a universal philosophy of history, one that has a necessitarian character about it. Let's consider this problem by way of a picture or a diagram. Think of Hegel and Marx looking back on history up to the 19th century. It's easy to recognize who is Hegel and who is Marx because, of course, Marx is right side up and Hegel is upside down because Marx has turned Hegel on his head. But Hegel is still grinning because as he looks back upon the history of the world, he sees everything progressing. There has been a steady, straight-line progression up to his time. To be sure, that is naive in itself, isn't it? There isn't a single straight-line progression in history. It depends entirely upon what you're dealing with. Some things get better, other things get worse, some stay the same. If you want to do a history of plumbing, for example, you could probably do a straight-line representing progress, eh? Never have we had toilets that work with such efficiency as we have them today. The toilet of 1970 is vastly superior to the toilet of 1920, and so on back through history. Certain things we can take and regard as a matter of straight-line progress, but surely that isn't the case in every area of life. If you think it is, just supply me with a Michelangelo or a Leonardo da Vinci. I could certainly use such a thing as I go into the Met and find those pictures that have been hung upside down with no one knowing it. I mean, surely we are not exactly at the zenith of artistic endeavor today. It depends on what you're looking at. But for the purpose of argument, let's just say that history had progressed in a straight-line fashion up to the mid-19th century. What would that say necessarily about the future? Answer, nothing. Why? Because you can't tell what proportion of history is still coming up. You can't tell the proportion of history that's already gone by as compared to what is taking place. Moreover, there is no way to be sure that the history that has already occurred is an adequate statistical sampling of the whole, of the entirety of history. Only if you could be sure that it was an adequate statistical sampling could you generalize on the basis of it. Think back to your statistics course. When you took a course in statistics, you were given a simple analogy as to how to get a random sample. The analogy undoubtedly had to do with a big pot of stew. You have a vat of stew. Now, to get a statistical sampling, a sample of the stew, which is adequate, you have got to stir up the stew. Because if you don't stir up the stew and you just take the ladle off the top, you will get a clear gruel. whereas if you dip way down, you will get heavy gunk. So in order to get a proper sampling of the stew, I'm referring here, of course, not to a French pot-au-feu, which would be magnificent. I'm referring to an old, ugly American stew. In order to get an adequate statistical sampling, you must stir all of this up, see? And as the gunk begins circulating in the gruel, you will finally arrive at a point where you can dip in and take out a ladle full, and the ladle will have the same proportion of gunk to gruel as exists in the universe of stew. All right, that's the way you get a statistical sampling. You've got to make sure that your sample adequately represents the universe from which you are taking the sample. Now, how does anybody stir up universal history to take out a sampling, I ask? Nobody can do this. You don't know what proportion of history is yet to come, and thus you do not know how to generalize on the basis of what you already have. In other words, you could extrapolate from a straight line progress on to the future, but that is whistling in the dark, because not only could history keep on going onward and upward, it could also go down and up and up and down and down and up and up and down until crash! There is a tremendous catastrophe at the end of history. There is no necessity for the line continually to move onward and upward. What would be the condition necessary for knowing where history was going? The condition would be to be able to look at it from the outside. Only if you could stand outside of history could you have a sufficient perspective on it to understand the whole of it. In other words, as long as you are locked into history at a given point, you can only see it from that perspective. You would have to be able to stand outside of it, away from it, at a sufficient distance to be able to look at all of it, and then, and only then, would you be able to indicate the meaning of all of it. But it should be obvious that no human being is capable of doing. You would need a god to do that. He would have to be outside of history, see it, and then tell you what it meant. But how could he tell you what it meant? He could tell you what it meant in two ways. He could send you a letter, postmarked eternity. Dear Earthling, it is unfortunate that you are unable to see more than what your own perspective allows. I am out here, able to look at all of it, and I'm going to tell you what it means. It means, colon, and then he tells you. That would be one way of doing it, by sending a letter. Another way, of course, would be to come himself and tell you what it means. Now, of course, the Christian faith is affirming exactly these two things. The Christian faith says that God spoke through prophets and apostles to tell you what the world is coming to, and that he came in the person of his own Son. There was an invasion from outer space, from outer metaphysical space. God came into our world, and he told us what history meant. And that, in principle, is the only way that we could ever find out. In other words, if we wanted to diagram it, we would have a sweeping arrow coming from outer space down into the world, and the meaning of history would be given to us. Do you remember good old Archimedes? Good old Archimedes. Alvin was his first name, in case you wondered about that. Good old Archimedes. He was the one, you know, who was jailed for indecent exposure in old Athens as a result of his discovery of the displacement of water. He leapt out of the bathtub, ran down the main street screaming, "Eureka! Eureka!" meaning in Greek, "I have found it," but the local authorities were not terribly impressed with this, and they made sure that that sort of thing didn't go on, because you can't have that going on in Athens, or in other localities, even though one is arriving at very important scientific results. But the reason that I mention Archimedes is not so much for that purpose. It's because of a statement he made about moving the world. He said, Archimedes, if you gave me a lever long enough and a fulcrum outside the world, I could move it. And of course, that's absolutely correct. That is absolutely correct physically. No matter how big and heavy the world is, if you had a long enough lever and a fulcrum outside the world, you could arrive at a point where simply by touching the lever with even the lightest touch, you could move it. But the necessary condition is to have a fulcrum outside the world. You can't move something if you are yourself in it or on it. That's pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. You've got to have a fulcrum, a perspective outside of it in order to move it. Do you recall those early Christians? It was said of them that they turned the world upside down, in a much more profound sense than Marx turned Hegel upside down. And how were the Christians able to turn the world upside down? Because they had a fulcrum outside the world. They had a divine perspective, and that divine perspective came from God Almighty entering into the world and indicating what the whole business meant. You see, in principle, the only way to understand the meaning of history is to have that kind of a perspective. And you can't get that kind of perspective as a human being because you are necessarily limited to the spot in which you find yourself. The Bible expresses this kind of thing by way of the Tower of Babel, for example. Tower of Babel is the human effort to climb up to heaven. That's trying to understand the world under your own steam. Tower of Babel, an attempt to reach heaven. Obviously, it's impossible. The tower is knocked down. People's language is confused. They lose the ability to communicate as a result of trying to do something that is out of their realm of possibility. Jesus says, no man has ascended up into heaven. The Son of Man has come down from heaven. The Christian faith can be symbolized by an arrow coming down to man and giving him what he needs. You see, philosophers of history don't have trouble because they lack vim, vigor, and vitality. They have all the vitamins that anybody else has, and they work very hard. The trouble is that no matter how hard they work, in principle, they have no assurance of getting answers. They have three strikes against them to begin with. They are caught in what is called technically the human predicament. The human predicament. This is the expression for being limited by one's own perspective and by one's own stance. Not being able to see the future, they are caught in a situation in which they can only talk in terms of what they have had contact with, and their generalizations are limited. The only way out of the human predicament is to get a perspective from outside of the world, namely an eternal perspective. The great analytical philosopher, the founder, really, of analytical philosophy in the 20th century, Ludwig Wittgenstein, emphasized exactly this point at the end of his Tractatus when he talked about ethics and morals. He said, any true ethic would have to be transcendental. Transcendental, meaning that if there were any absolute, it would have to be outside of the world and not conditioned by it. Of course, Wittgenstein didn't think that there was one. He didn't see any way of getting to one. But he quite correctly analyzed the situation as prohibiting that kind of an absolute on any other terms. All right. Let's turn now to the area of ethics and the law. And you already see the way in which we're moving. I want to show you that this same fundamental theme applies in ethics and the law just as it applies in philosophy of history. Namely, that unless you've got an eternal perspective, you are up the metaphysical creek. Again, let's go back to the 19th century. In the 19th century, people had more or less outgrown God. We mentioned in another of our sessions that in the 19th century, people sincerely shook God's hand and thanked Him for past favors rendered and attempted to go on by themselves. In the area of the law, this is reflected in what is called technically legal positivism or legal realism. Legal positivism or legal realism. The position is generally called positivism in England and on the continent, and it's called legal realism here in the United States. The view is this, that laws simply grow up in social situations. Laws are the reflection of a society. In our country, this position was particularly expressed by Oliver Wendell Holmes. In his expression, judge-made law. Law is what judges declare it to be. Law arises through judicial decision. And judicial decision, inevitably, is a reflection of the values of the society. In other words, in the 19th century, people had pretty well gotten away from the notion of eternal law or absolute law or revelational law. But this didn't worry anybody. Why? Because everything was progressing. Everything was going onward and upward. So particular societies were going to arrive at higher law anyway. They were going to get to higher legal values naturally, and all societies would grow together, and finally humanity would express itself perfectly in legal and moral absolutes. Sounded peachy keen, no question about it, but then in our own time came the world wars. And World War II is particularly interesting in this regard, because when the smoke cleared at the end of World War II, it was discovered that one of the combatants, Nazi Germany, had developed a legal system which depersonalized the Jewish race. Jews under National Socialism were not regarded as persons under the law. They were regarded somewhat as slaves had been regarded here in the United States prior to emancipation. They were considered chattels or things, and they were treated as such. They did not have legal protection. They were regarded much as the fetus is regarded during the first trimester of pregnancy since our Supreme Court decision. That is, not as persons, but as things and without legal protection. As a result of this, 6 million Jews were destroyed. Not that many fetuses have been destroyed, but it may well be that if this damnable situation continues in our land, that we will be able eventually to count a greater number of human beings eliminated from the face of the earth in our country than were eliminated under the Third Reich. I don't know. Human beings ought not to be snuffed out simply because they're not capable of defending their own rights. And you got human beings there, everybody. From the moment of conception, the complete genetic pattern is established. You need nothing more than nutriment. From that point on, you've got a human being. You do not have a tumor. And to eliminate people simply because they can't express themselves might very well eliminate students who can't express themselves. And there are a lot of them. I've taught for a number of years, and there's no question about that. So we want to be very careful and not define humanity in terms of ability to express oneself or to defend one's own interests. All right. At the end of the Second World War, it was discovered that the Nazis had actually developed a legal system that destroyed human beings in vast numbers. Now, what was going to be done about this? War crimes trials took place at the end of the Second World War, the famous Nuremberg trials. And at the Nuremberg trials, the prosecution argued that there are fundamental moral absolutes and higher laws that prohibit a country from doing the sort of thing that Nazi Germany did. the military tribunal, the International Military Tribunal, established for the purpose of trying Goering and company, asserted that there are fundamental laws that go above and beyond the laws of individual peoples and that can be used for judging individual peoples if anything like this happens. The defendants, however, argued that such a notion was entirely out of whack as far as modern secular life was concerned. They said, everybody knows that laws are the product of a society. Our laws are simply the product of our society. How can you condemn us because we've developed a legal system different from yours? Why, you're judging us on the basis of ex post facto laws. You're judging us on the basis of laws that we never accepted ourselves and that you have developed after the conflict ends. The defendants at Nuremberg argued in exactly the modern spirit, where each nation has a right to its own laws and no nation has a right to judge another nation. Let me give you an example of that kind of legal theory. This comes from Hans Kelsen, who died just a couple of years ago and who delivered a lecture on this subject at the University of California at Los Angeles. And this is the argument of Kelsen. Listen to this. Quote, "It is of the greatest importance to be aware of the fact that there is not only one moral or political system, but at different times and within different societies, several different moral and political systems are considered to be valid by the men living under these normative systems. These systems actually came into existence by custom, or by the commands of outstanding personalities like Moses, or Jesus, or Muhammad. If men believe that these personalities are inspired by a transcendental, supernatural, that is, divine authority, the moral or political system has a religious character. It is especially in this case, when the moral or political system is supposed to be of divine origin, that the values constituted by it are considered to be absolute. If, however, the fact is taken into consideration that there are, there were, and probably always will be several different moral and political systems actually presupposed to be valid within different societies, the values constituted by these systems can be considered to be only relative. Then the judgment that a definite government or definite legal order is just can be pronounced only with reference to one of the several different political and moral systems, and then the same behavior or the same governmental activity or the same legal order may, with reference to another moral or political system, be considered as morally bad or politically unjust." Unquote. Kelsen is saying here, the different laws simply arise from different societies, and one society can't judge another because the other society could come right back and judge it. It's true that there are people who think that their laws have a divine origin, but the fact of the matter is that there is a wide diversity of laws and customs, and therefore the whole situation is relative. That legal theory, which can be found in another form in H.L.A. Hart, the greatest living authority in jurisprudence, professor of jurisprudence at Oxford, that legal theory is exactly what the defendants were arguing at Nuremberg. But of course, nobody listened to that kind of thing at Nuremberg, not with 6 million Jews having been gassed out of existence. At Nuremberg, the argument was there is a higher law and these people are going to be judged by it. Our chief prosecutor was Associate Justice Robert Jackson of the Supreme Court. He is now deceased. He is one of the greatest jurists of the 20th century. And this is a paragraph from Jackson's summing up of the case for the prosecution at Nuremberg. Listen to this. "We should not overlook the unique and emergent character of this body as an international military tribunal. It is no part of the constitutional mechanism of internal justice of any of the signatory nations. As an international military tribunal, it rises above the provincial and the transient, and seeks guidance not only from international law, but also from the basic principles of jurisprudence, which are the assumptions of civilization." the basic principles of jurisprudence, which are the assumptions of civilization. In other words, says Jackson, we have got to appeal to something more fundamental and basic than the laws that arise in the particular societies. But here we are faced with a wee dilemma, aren't we? Where do you get the moral and legal principles that transcend the laws of the societies? Where do we get those? It is said that water does not rise above its own level, eh? And the laws and the customs and the moral values that people express are obviously the product of their society to a very large extent. In a cannibal society, the rule exists, clean your plate. A very important moral rule, but clearly arising out of the nature of the anthropophagous society. Our laws and our rules arise from our particular social perspective. And the defendants at Nuremberg said, listen, you people are judging us because you're Americans and you're Britishers and you're French. We don't look at it that way. Says Jackson at Nuremberg, there are higher principles. And one of these is that you don't gas people simply because they are members of a particular race. But he never justifies that principle. He simply asserts it. Some Germans have said that the Nuremberg trials are just an example of the fact that war trials are held by the victors, and that they were simply the victims of those who won the war. And others have said, and I think with a certain amount of legitimacy, that we never received even a criticism for dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is a generally accepted notion that there is a distinction between civilians and combatants in wartime. We argued that this was perfectly justified because American boys were losing their lives. Sure, American boys were losing their lives, but they were, after all, combatants, weren't they? They were combatants who had been attacked, right, but they were at least combatants, whereas the people who were incinerated at Nagasaki and Hiroshima were, in many instances, women and children who had absolutely no military connection. I think that Buchbacher, the French historian, who is a great friend of the United States, is absolutely right when he says that this is one of the most hideous moral acts in human history, to do a thing like that. It would have been perfectly possible to drop the bomb in an area where it wouldn't have caused that kind of destruction so that they could see the effect of it, and you could have a gradual escalation of droppings so that if they didn't accede to the situation, it might eventually get to the point of a severe loss of life. But to begin with the dropping of the bomb on a civilian city is damnable, is just ghastly. And of course, there wasn't anything done about that because we were the victors. Now, the point of all of this is, isn't it, that you would need some sort of eternal justification of law and morals in order to state something that transcended society. And where are you going to get this? Well, let me quote a few lines from Rousseau's Social Contract. It is very difficult for me ever to find an opportunity to quote Rousseau positively, because he was not exactly the most profound philosopher who ever hit this earth. You know that Rousseau did an educational treatise called Émile, which was the basis of progressive education. In Émile, the kid is allowed to develop according to his own capacities, and he's never forced to learn anything. He learns according to his own interests. A nobleman of the 18th century brought up his son on the basis of those principles. This is an actual situation. And when the kid reached 18 years of age, the nobleman wrote to a friend of his. He said, I have assiduously followed the views of Rousseau in Émile, and my son is an imbecile. The kid had not learned anything because Rousseau didn't have an adequate understanding of sin and the effect of sin on people. The fact is that we are not eager to learn. You know, some of us are perhaps more a little more inclined in that direction than others, but laziness is a sort of corollary of original sin. And all of us tend to prefer the surfboard to the library. It's that sort of thing, eh? Well, Rousseau, nonetheless, sets forth the exact situation when he writes in The Social Contract. Listen to this. It's in the chapter on the legislator, and Rousseau is talking about what it would take to provide a proper legislator. Quote, "In order to discover the rules of society best suited to nations, a superior intelligence, beholding all the passions of men, without experiencing any of them, would be needed. This intelligence would have to be wholly unrelated to our nature," Rousseau here means our self-centered nature, huh? "Wholly unrelated to our nature while knowing it through and through. Its happiness would have to be independent of us and yet ready to occupy itself with ours. And lastly, it would have in the march of time to look forward to a distant glory and working in one century, be able to enjoy in the next. It would take gods to give men laws." It would take gods to give men laws. See, Rousseau looks at the human race and he sees that in order to get proper laws, you couldn't very well get them from the kind of people you find around, because people are self-centered and they develop laws and customs according to their own interests. So you'd have to have a legislator who was able to behold all the passions of men without being subjected to them. Also, he would have to look across the centuries, because he'd have to be sure that the laws and customs would be suitable for people not just in one period of time, but as history changes. And Rousseau quickly recognizes that under those circumstances, the only proper legislator would be a god, somebody who would be able to understand men but not be subject to their failings. Well, of course, we're right back at the same place we were in discussing philosophy of history, aren't we? We're at the place where we see that you would need to have laws and morals coming in from outside the human situation, from a god who could see the whole picture and who would really know what was proper for everybody. You'd have to have that in order to be able to arrive at any absolutes. Necessarily, if you don't have that, the only laws and morals you're going to get are those that each society produces. They're going to be limited to the perspective of the society. And if that's the situation, you never really can judge the kind of atrocities that took place at Nuremberg or at Hiroshima. You don't have any standards by which to do this. The Christian faith claims that the same God who came down to earth and told us where history was going, told us what are the proper moral laws and the ethical absolutes. And Holy Scripture, which he put his stamp of approval upon and which he inspired through the Holy Spirit, Holy Scripture gives us the moral laws and the bases for positive law that we so desperately need. A person who tries to find eternal law apart from revelation has as much trouble doing it as the philosopher of history who tries to explain history apart from revelation. The human predicament keeps him from success. It isn't a lack of effort, a lack of energy that causes the trouble. The trouble is a logical one, namely that he is caught in history himself and he is subject to the moral laws and the positive regulations of his own time. Now, you can apply this same operation to any area where a person is trying to get ultimates, where he's trying to find absolute answers. Anywhere a person tries to get the solution to things, whether it's in history or law or morals or science or art or any field, he will not be able to rise above his own limitations. In all of these instances, you've got to have a revelational invasion from outer space in order to provide the answers. This is why Christ is, in the most real sense, the answer to the questions that people raise about life. Without Christ, without that kind of an invasion, even in principle, you could never be sure of your answers. Now, an objection has been raised to this, and I want to mention it to you so that you see it up against what I've just been saying. Some people have said in looking at this, but how do you know that you have a revelation? You know you have a revelation only by examining history. But you've already said that the only way to understand history would be to have a revelation. Under those circumstances, aren't you engaged in a circular reasoning? Aren't you in a position where, unless you first of all had a revelation, you wouldn't be able to make any sense out of history, and therefore, without a prior revelation, you wouldn't be able to check a revelation out. So you're unable, in principle here, to be able to show that such an invasion occurred. This sounds a bit persuasive if it's presented carefully, but it isn't persuasive at all. That is not a sound argument, and it's not a sound argument for the following reason. What you can't do apart from revelation is to understand the totality of history. You can't put all the pieces together to arrive at a general interpretation of the whole works because of your limited perspective. You're not able to get all the pieces, for one thing. You're not able to know what pieces are up there in the future. So your puzzle is never sufficiently complete to be assembled. However, apart from revelation, you can still investigate particular events. Your investigation of particular events and your drawing of conclusions from particular events is still possible. For example, you may not be able, apart from revelation, to understand where history is going in the large. But it's no trouble at all to determine that Lincoln was shot in Ford's Theater and did not slip on a banana peel in Peoria. That you can definitely do. You do not need revelation for that. Nor do you need revelation to arrive at an interpretation of his death in Ford's Theater. That is, you can arrive pretty effectively at the conclusion that there was a conspiracy, John Wilkes Booth was involved in this, etc., etc. In other words, you can build up a picture of Lincoln's death and indeed of Lincoln's administration, which is almost universally recognized and accepted, and you can do that whether you believe in revelation or not. That kind of investigation is definitely possible. But to put Lincoln's administration into the perspective of eternity, you cannot do unless you've got a revelation, which says something as to what eternal values are and the rest of it. Now, the importance of this is that apart from revelation, you can investigate the death of Christ just as you can investigate the death of Lincoln. You can determine that Jesus died on a cross in Jerusalem and did not fall into the Rubicon. And you can, by way of the very same manuscripts, the very same manuscript materials, arrive at the conclusion that he didn't stay dead. He rose again from the dead. You can find from these materials that he claimed to be God and based his deity on his resurrection, and the resurrection did, in fact, occur. And you can interpret this by way of his own understanding of this. You can ask him, how come you rose from the dead? Why did that happen? And his answer is, because I'm God Almighty, I came to earth to die for the sins of the world and to reveal the nature of things. And thus, you see, through an investigation of a particular historical event, you can arrive at a revelational base. And then you can look at that revelational base, you can look at the scriptures that he attested, you can look at his teachings, and you can arrive at a conclusion as to what history in the large means. So there isn't anything circular about saying that you need revelation to understand history, and yet at the same time, by investigating a particular event of history, you can come to revelation. If you understand this method that we've been talking about, you'll find it of tremendous utility and value in dealing with non-Christians. Try to keep in mind, in dealing with a non-Christian, that he is up against a problem that he can't solve. He is limited by the perspective that he has, by his moral values, the values of his society, by the analysis that he's able to do himself personally or that other people are able to do around him. But there is no way of showing that any of that can rise to the level of the absolute. So, the non-Christian's choice is very simple. It's either to live in an inexplicable world or investigate a claim that will provide meaning for this world in which he finds himself. And the non-Christian who takes the attitude, well, you know, who cares, this sort of thing, you can very well quote Socrates too, when Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. Surely, if there is even a chance that the meaning of life can come through the investigation of a particular historical event, it's worth spending a little time on that, eh? Any non-Christian who has taken one single course in college has spent enough time on that subject that would go beyond what would probably be necessary for checking out the case for Christianity. And you can use that kind of an argument with non-Christians, that if they would spend a fraction of the time that they spend on any number of other things to check this out, they could very well find the answer to the whole business.